This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm interviewing Mary Kay Zaravlev, who's written a novel called Man Alive, and note that there's an exclamation point after the alive. So it's probably Man Alive.
I like that. That's a good pronunciation.
How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's fun to do this. I loved your book. I'm sure other people have said to you that it's amazing that you are able to write a book that includes so much pain and do it in such a lighthearted and enjoyable, fun way, without losing sight of the seriousness of the content. Am I right that's something others have observed?
Well, not as articulately as you have. I love the way you said that, because it's really tricky. You know, when I described it to a bookseller the other day, you know, they had the independent bookseller days, shop small, mm-hmm. and they had authors volunteering. And so this woman said, "Well, what is your book about?" And I said, it's about a psychiatrist who's struck by lightning, and now it reverberates through the family. She said, that sounds terrifying.
Well, it is terrifying.
It is. I said, well, there's some humor, too. There's a lot of humor, too. But it is tricky to describe it on that fence, right?
Well, the book is hilarious, and that kind of keeps you from falling into the misery and pain that some of the characters in your book are in as this event reverberates. And so, you know, we won't give away what happens, but I love on your website the one paragraph version, which I think is something that a lot of books could benefit from, you know, in four lines basically telling the story of the book without giving away what happens. That takes some skill, I think, to do. But I love the opening scene of the book, which I think is, you know, we can talk about, obviously, your main character, whose name is Owen Lerner, is a pediatric psychiatrist. He's on vacation in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, mm-hmm. and it's just the end of the summer, and they're, you know, maybe a day or two before they close up the summer house, and they head back to D.C., to go back to work and life, and he's putting a quarter into the parking meter, and this, without him realizing it, he's struck by lightning and thrown way up into the air and falls down. And it's a great scene. You have no idea at that point where things are going to go. You know, it's kind of, I would call your style in this kind of madcap. You know, it sort of feels like maybe a Jerry Lewis movie.
Well, that's another thing. So there's the pain, and then there's the daily life, and then there's also the humor as well as the literary side of it. So, you know, how do you characterize this novel? My husband said, you don't like it when people call you a comic novelist, but you love it when they said they laughed out loud, which is exactly true.
Well, that is true, and you can't resist being, you know, labels are not fair, but obviously people do reduce whole experiences into a few words, and it is a comedic novel, and we were starting to say, it takes a lot of skill, I think, to balance the humor against the seriousness, because what happens to the doctor then is his entire life changes as his brain has literally been fried. And you are tracking not only what happens to him, but all of the people in his family and people around him. That's what the story's about.
And not only has his brain been fried, but there's some ecstatic element of it too. So he's been dramatically harmed, but he also, there's a real charm for him of everything firing at once and all of the fireworks going off, and he sort of feels that he has seen this other element that he would love to stick around in, and that is not anything that the rest of the family wants to hear.
No, in a lot of ways, I thought about this a lot, that what, if you've ever read anything describing the mystical experience, you know, of revelations that people have when they enter into a mystic state, and there are many, many of those that you can find, that are very similar to what happens to your character, Dr. Lerner, and that is they enter another dimension within the that I think that the brain, in fact, includes in it. And there's that desire to stay in that space, as you call it, ecstatic.
Or to chase after it, too. You know, one point he thinks, oh my gosh, am I going to be looking up all the drugs that have sort of ethereal properties, and am I going to be chasing after those?
Well, that would
one
be,
critic, yeah. There's my first novel is also about electricity. I have this electricity fetish. And one critic called me a secular metaphysicist, which I love.
That's
because,
in
fact, there's plenty of that, but not a lot of religion, right? There's plenty of sort of mysticism and spirituality, but no religion.
Right. No, it's not religious. But that's true of mysticism and, you know, that itself, it is a religious in a certain way, because every religion, almost every religion, includes mystics who have these visions that are really not, they don't fit into the day-to-day understanding of religion, in the same way that his visionary experience of being struck by lightning takes him outside of everyday life and he can't fit back in. What happens to him is he's displaced completely, and he's this person, his wife doesn't understand, his children don't understand, as you describe him, you know, he stops dressing well, you know, he looks like, you know, I can sort of imagine he looks like a schlub, basically, you know,
or a sausage. He's sort of extruded into his clothes.
Oh,
he wears these spandex bike pants.
Right. And he wants to eat barbecue, you know, he wants to recapture that smell, the feeling, the you know, the kind of, elemental, that, you know, he probably doesn't realize it until later in the book that what he is trying to recapture is the smell of his own flesh burning. But, you know, that's what he's after, is this kind of metaphysical desire to barbecue.
And very primitive, right? I mean, just what you said, there's the visionary element, but then there's the get large hunks of meat, throw them on the fire, feed family.
Right, which is also outside of the everyday. So you've taken him and made him, you know, into this, you know, he's displaced. You know, he's no longer part of the way everyday life works, although he is brought back, and I'd probably really want to be careful not to give it away, but the events of his family's actual lives force him to return to their reality, even though now maybe he's by the end kind of inhabited his, you know, he's made that initial experience, this crazy thing that happened to him, it's become more adapted into his persona rather than being simply other.
And will they adapt to it too? I mean, there's this amazing story by Primo Levi called Man's Friend, I think it's called. Do you know that story by any chance?
No, I don't.
So it's about an ancient Near Eastern scholar who recognizes that these tapeworms that people have expelled have a coded side, and he can translate them as a cuneiform script, and they're poems to the host that they have inhabited.
Oh,
it's just a phenomenal story. And so it says, you know, do not eschew the garlic and do not expel me. but the reason I bring that up is because when I read that story for years, I just liked the inventiveness of it. But then one time I was reading it, and I thought, oh, this is a Holocaust story, and this is about the worst thing that could possibly happen is that God turns his face from you. God ignores you, right? I mean, some people describe hell that way, that out of God's favor. And in this family, that he wants to chase that ecstatic moment and not really pay attention to them is the most sort of affront that he could possibly visit on them. And he's thinking, yeah, I love them. I love my socks too. But they cannot imagine that he would want to court this horrible thing that has happened to him. All they can think is, get back to normal. And he's thinking, normal? No. This is enhanced. This is better than normal.
Right. Well, and I guess I'm interested in, you know, the dynamic there. From your perspective, do you feel that this character, whose side, let me ask it this way, whose side are you on? You know,
I'm on all of their sides. I mean, that's the novelist. That's the novelist's position, right? But I had read the impetus for this was I had read this nonfiction article by Oliver Sacks about a doctor who was struck by lightning. So this guy was a surgeon, and in Sacks's piece on him, he talks about how he actually heard piano compositions. Maybe you read this article. And so he, in fact, this guy stops being a surgeon. He leaves his wife. This is his real life. And he learns how to play the piano and annotate music so he can capture those compositions. And when I first read that article, I loved it as a metaphor because that's how I had always described writing to people. I'd always said I had this song in my head and I couldn't quite get it. I wasn't good enough. I didn't have enough practice. So the idea that he heard this music completely composed was amazing to me. But then I just took this other turn and I just had the thought, pediatric psychopharmacologist struck by lightning, all he wants to do is barbecue. So then I just went with that and that started the whole story. Whose side am I on? I'm on the side of the chance happening between random and did he attract it or did it just happen to him? And now what? How it all falls out, how the dominoes now fall.
Yeah, no, I think I was not, you know, literally meaning that you had to take sides within the story, but I was sort of thinking about that tension, you know, the dramatic tension between where he wants to be and where his family wants him to be, which is sort of similar, you know, when you read about spiritual leaders saying, I don't want to be a spiritual leader, but the people around me make me be their leader. And it's almost like the father here is saying, you know, I had this out-of-body experience, and I want to be out of my body again. And you're
and I love that you said whose side am I on, because that really is part of the book. I mean, that families are teams, and they sort of make change alliances, and you know, they regroup all the time, and that's what's going on in this book. And there's a moment where he says to his wife, this has nothing to do with you.
Right.
And that is just so offensive.
Right. But he means it literally. He doesn't mean to be offensive because at that point he's not even aware of who she is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another thing is that you're observing, maybe you're, you know, by exaggerating this, you're talking about how people interact with each other in families, and it changes over time, but especially married couples who
they've been together a long time.
Although they both were married once before, but they're pretty committed. They've been together a long time. Each of them has, you know, in the course of a long marriage, you do harm each other and forgive each other, or scars grow over those you know, those wounds that are sometimes not forgiven, but just simply buried. And so she's got some of that going on with him. And, you know, there's a whole, I think there's a lot of interaction between husband and wife, or male and female here in this committed relationship that you're exploring as maybe in exaggerated form and maybe in comedic form, but there's always a reality under there in terms of the way the way people are really interacting.
Well, that's I guess why when people say, you know, satire, it's like, no, it's not satire. Comedy, well, no, it's not satire, because I'm so glad you said reality, because when someone sometimes writes me a note and they'll say, oh my God, you captured that notion of sort of loving someone and also wanting to wring their neck at exactly the same moment, or maybe 1 second later. You know, and with kids, it's like that all the time, where you're so worried about, where were you, where were you? And then you find out that they're safe and they just, you know, left their phone at the 7-Eleven and just didn't bother to call you. I'm going to kill you now.
Well, and the kids in your story, there are three kids. The older two are twins. I think it's okay to talk about that. But each one of them is also got a lot of stuff going on, and not necessarily good.
They're just as thrown. I mean, the sort of visual metaphor I had going in my head was that you have all the pool balls on a table, and they're all racked up. It's just as you said, it's the last night they're all together before vacation ends, and they're all going to pack up and go, and the boys will go to college, and the girl will be the only one left at home. She's 16. And that lightning is just like the pool cue and the cue that just throws them completely out of their tight alignment. And so as you're following them, and one of the things that happened to make it go from a short story to a novel, because it had started just as a story, just as kind of a one-liner. And then as I started exploring point of view, the novel is told in what I'm calling family point of view. So you hear from each character, but nobody outside the family. And that happened because I said, all of a sudden was in Will, one of the boys' heads, and I was thinking about what a rich life we each have that we don't share, no matter how close you are to the people that you're with.
No, I was struck by that.
And I thought, maybe that's just me.
No, I was struck by that. I have three kids, and they're of the age that I don't see them every day anymore. And I know, I think about that a lot, that they have rich, full daily lives of their own, and it's impossible either for them to experience my life fully anymore or for me to experience their lives fully anymore. And that's, I don't want to say sad, but it's certainly different to know.
Yeah, and it's kind of incredible, isn't it? Like, to think that, you know, you gave birth to these kids, well, you didn't technically, but that they were with you in the years where you knew everything about them.
Right.
Certainly not what was going on in their head, but as those thoughts were formed, you knew them. And now, because I have one in college and one in junior high, and that life separate from us is very alarming, even if it's just totally normal.
Yeah, well, because
it hits you all the time.
And there's so much going on that you can't know, and there's so much that can happen to them that is good or bad, but the things you worry about are the things that affect them as people that you can, not only do you have no control over, but you don't even realize is going on. And that's what makes them, you know, they're now becoming fully formed adults. But as you show in Man Alive, it's not always a linear process where, and it's often going to be a process, as most people know if they have children and families, that there are a lot of bumps and things that are swerving, you know, swerves that, I mean, the thing you dread is getting that phone call, you know, for that your kid is, whatever it may be. And you've got some of that in this book, which, again, I don't want to give away, that are pretty
but there's
major.
A scene, I'll give something away that isn't giving away plot. There's a scene toward the end of the book where Will and his dad are out next to the barbecue pit. And Will says to his dad, you know, I'm terrified. And his father says, of what? And I remember writing that and thinking, yeah, what is he afraid of? And he's basically saying, now I'm afraid of everything. Because when something that awful happens in your life, I mean, just like you were talking about the terror that you have for your kids, I mean, I remember when my son closed his hand in the car door, and he was perfectly fine. And then I said to him, okay, now every single time you close the door, I'm going to have to say, watch your hand, watch your hand, watch your hand. Because it opens that possibility. And so, you know, like the fact that this has happened to them opens this possibility that life is really terrifying, and anything can happen on any given day. If lightning can come out of the sky and hit you, what are the odds of that? Yeah, well, it happened.
Well, lightning is the perfect metaphorical thing to use to stand in for all of the things that could happen to any one of us in the world. You know, the kind of classic, I could walk across the street and be hit by a bus. And you say that kind of offhandedly because the odds of it happening are so slim. But if you, and of course we live our lives not thinking about each of those things that could happen to us. But if you look at it kind of then kind of epidemiologically as a group of people, lots of bad things are going to happen to a lot of people. And so what you're showing here is in a lot of ways not uncommon. It may be it's uncommon for lightning to strike, but it isn't uncommon for someone to lose their job unexpectedly or for a family member to be injured or you know, something bad to happen that has this, and what you're showing is the massive effect as it spreads out from that event that in many ways you could say, well, those aren't necessarily connected, and they are. You can't really know what is cause and effect in any of the in all of the ways that people interact with each other. But it's,
well, and there's a scene where Tony is the wife, and she's just by herself having a glass of wine after work, and she's thinking about how they've just gone up and up and up and up, you know, and they got married and they had these children and the children are healthy and they got a house at the beach and, you know, the sort of lucky life that they've led, though they've worked very hard and they've, you know, been devoted parents and up, 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 up. And she said, but doesn't something crappy happen to everyone? I mean, just like you said, couldn't it be your job? Couldn't it be a terrible car accident? Couldn't it be, God forbid, illness? And how do you recover from that? And how do you sort of get back up on the slope, as it were?
Yeah, and I found myself feeling that through the book. Not in a bad way, but certainly it's a reminder, you know, that, you know, because kind of accidentally, I think during the time I was reading this book, some friend of mine did have something really bad happen, and I was thinking, well, now this could be happening to them. You know, all of these effects could be running through the lives of that person's family. It's just, you know,
it's interesting that you say that, because I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I've been going to book clubs now, and that's just fascinating to have people who've read your book sort of read it back to you. And a lot of people will say, I don't know you, but I was reading this and I'm wondering if maybe somebody in your family had a stroke, or I was reading this and maybe if somebody had lost a kid, right? That they could see so much of any tragedy that they had experienced in the book. And I thought, boy, that's kind of a compliment. I'm sorry that they had to go through that. And in fact, so many books are about the loss of a parent or the loss of, you know, something bad happens. So one of the things that this is a little different in this book is that there is a lot of kind of brain chemistry. I mean, he's a doctor. He is his job. He's the go-to guy in his community for kids with ADD and autism and Asperger's and PDD, all the alphabet soup of disorders, he calls it. And he's the one. He's the one that is most practiced at kind of the pharmacological cocktails that bring these kids around, if in fact medication can bring them around. And then he has this experience with the lightning, and, you know, what is that but an electrical storm in his head? And now he has all those symptoms. He's impulsive, and he has post-traumatic stress, and he has attention issues. And so it's like, ooh, now it's personal. And he revisits the kind of neurotypical life. How, what would that look like? And do we really yearn for it? Is that really something we should compete for? Which is kind of big in our community where we live. I mean, these kids are, and this is another thing about taking sides. You know, I'm not voting in or out, because, in fact, whenever you do have a kid who has issues, you'll do anything. You know, you'll do exercise and diet and Taekwondo, and you'll try medication because you see that this kid is suffering. But there's also an element of, like, have we so narrowly defined what it means to be in this community that this is the only way to be?
Well, that's true. Well, that is, in fact, in a way, the story you could read. That's one of the prismatic ways of reading your book, and that is,
yeah, what's normal,
right? And here's a guy who has been taken out of everyday reality. How does the world look at him? You know, how do the people around him? Do they expand their consciousness in order to? Because of what they see happening to him, and in the case of his family, they can't do that. It's too much for them to go where he's gone and try to. That's, you know, that you sort of see that in the way our world is very much built on the idea that we want people to be creative and interesting, but within the boundaries of normality, whatever normality is going to be defined as. So if you do anything odd, people do notice. And
oh, yeah.
You know, and
I was thinking about the other day, my son, when he was really little, used to wear a cape and some other elaborate things, and then he would stand in the middle of the classroom and say, "Everybody, don't look at me." And it would just sort of blow people's minds. So people had different theories. You know, the teacher would say, "Oh, he's just looking for attention." And my favorite line was that she said, "He's using his imagination to disrupt the classroom." It's like, okay, what about he has an imagination? Can we start there?
Right.
But this friend of mine who's an artist said to me, "I know, I understand him." She said, "I put feathers in my hair. I did all these other things." And people would comment on it, and I would think, "Why don't you go show a little imagination? Stop stop talking about what I'm doing. Why don't you go over in the corner and make something interesting? And I think she really got it, that it wasn't necessarily about commanding attention. It was about being whoever the hell he wanted to be. And just as you said, I mean, he's looking at how kids should be treated, but his family's looking at him and thinking, I don't think we can really accept this as our definition of father.
No, that's true. And they kind of act out in their own ways, rebelling against what he's become. And then they kind of go off in their own direction.
Illness is very self-absorbing. I mean, one of the things that shocks Tony is that, you know, when she learns that things are going on outside the family, of course things are going on outside the family, and she thinks, oh my gosh, you know, I'm accusing him of being so self-absorbed, but in trying to treat him and in dealing with all the ramifications of what he's going through, I haven't even noticed that my best friend's son is sick. I haven't even noticed that my own daughter's making some terrible choices. So it's amazing how that can kind of... I remember my mother talking about how, you know, she raised us during the era of the Vietnam War and during the era of Nixon's resignation. And she said, you know, when people talk about that and they just say everybody was so tied up in it, she said, I was just trying to get three kids in snowsuits. Like, she said, I don't really think of myself as raising you during this tumultuous time. I just think of what it meant to do carpool.
Yeah.
And, you know, feed everybody and get dinner on the table.
Yeah.
Daily life is consuming.
Yeah. I think that's true for many people, that there are parts of the world that they don't remember because they were so involved with, just as you said, that it's the daily life, or it's they started a new job and this is the beginning of their career. So no, they don't remember whatever was going on in the outside
world.
Yeah,
we lost 6 months there, right? I mean, yeah. There's a scene where Tony's standing there and the newspapers have piled up and she's looking. It's right before the first Obama election. And she's looking and Sarah Palin's just been named the vice presidential candidate, and she's thinking, did I dream it? Or does this woman really try to shoot wolves out of helicopters? Could that be? Is she really an ex-beauty queen who does that? Or did I make that up? But she's just been so out of it. And when she thinks of it objectively, it just seems ludicrous.
Well, I think that's the perfect description of the book. There's objective and ludicrousness together at the same time. So I do want to ask you, is this, do you feel like there's a theme here that you will continue to explore in your writing, or by writing this, have you closed that chapter and you're on to something else?
Oh no, this is where I perch, and I'm just starting to get to be able to describe it. In the next book, I'm already thinking about hyperbolic space and Mormonism and Russian Orthodox immigrants and how that all... my editor said to me one day, oh, Mary Kay, you are the sum of your tangents.
That's really nice.
Yeah, I took it as a compliment. I'm not sure it was meant as one, but I do see a lot of things tying together in both absurd and meaningful ways. The world in a grain of sand. You know, I do love getting way, way, way up above things and then going right down into them.
Well, you did that in this book. I haven't read your other two books, so I can't say whether you did that in those, but I am trusting that you did. I'll be interested in your next book because I like the what you just described is the kind of unification of disparate pieces or disparate ideas and outlooks. I think that's interesting. I think by itself, it's interesting being able to manage the those different directions, which is what we started out talking about, managing this incredibly complex event that happens to your character with a kind of light touch for some pretty tough things. So it's impressive.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and I really appreciate being able to talk to you about your book. I've been talking to Mary Kay Zuravlev. The novel is Man Alive, and I really recommend it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.